You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 4th to the 10th of July 2013. We'll be discussing a range of issues, the use of dogs in gang culture, we'll be hearing about researchers who've crammed years of study into 3-minute pitches, we'll be asking how the global academy is bending to the winds of demographic change, and also hearing a little bit about the changing role of parents when their children are deciding which university to attend. My name is Chris Parr, I'm joined by reporter Jack Grove, editor John Gill and reporter Elizabeth Gibney. We've lots to tackle today, but we'll start with our lead news story this week, which was penned by Jack. The top line of it, 2/3 of university staff have never been rewarded for their teaching. That's according to a Higher Education Academy survey. What's it all about and why is this important?
Well, this is quite important because this year we've had tuition fees go up to £9,000 a year.
No.
We have indeed. But it seems that academics are promoted most often on the basis of their research. So while academics are being asked to do lots of teaching and up their game in that respect, there doesn't seem to be the processes built into their contracts and universities' procedures to reward them for their excellent teaching. And this is a study by the Higher Education Academy which tries to promote excellent teaching and make it a real central part of what university is all about. And they've, well, actually CEDA, which is a staff development organisation, they asked about 1,200 academics about whether they had been rewarded by their institutions for their commitment to teaching and student support. And only about a third of them had. And only 3.5% of them had been given financial rewards such as promotions or pay rises, and another 4% had been given one-off bonuses for excellent teaching. So it seems like that the rewards aren't really built into the system to reward excellent teaching, which might have been acceptable when tuition fees were £1,000 or teaching was totally free, but when students are now being asked to pay £9,000 a year and they expect excellent teaching, there's no reward or premium for academics to provide that.
So does this go back to that old battle between research and teaching and one being seen as superior to the other, or maybe academics feeling that one is superior to the other, do you think?
Well, I think very much so. At the moment, especially when we're in the run-up to the research excellence framework and everyone's really keen to be included in that, and that's a very concrete way of being assessed and your value within the department. But with teaching, it's harder to judge that. It's harder to say, I'm an excellent teacher, I get great feedback and from my students, and they're very entertained by me. But how do you quantify
it? I mean, that's always been the problem, hasn't it? It's very subjective whether or not a teacher is a good teacher, in a way that you can, I mean, people will argue with how you quantify the quality of research, but, you know, fairly well-respected or certainly at least well-used ways of measuring research are pretty well-established. But I think the thing that will really force universities to take this issue seriously will be when, you know, as in research currently, there are financial incentives. Implications and incentives for them if you're not taking teaching seriously or the promotion of good teachers seriously.
We do have things like the National Student Survey, which are starting to take, I think, a bit more prominence. People are listening to what the students have to say about the teaching. But it's difficult, isn't it, the incentive system? I mean, we don't want a teaching excellence framework.
No, absolutely.
Well, I'm think sure most people would say they wouldn't. But, the ref is just linked to money and prestige. And people respond to whatever incentives they're given.
And actually, there are universities out there that are doing, that are trying, you know, quite novel things. I know Edward Acton at UEA has spoken previously about sort of some very specific ways to include teaching excellence within promotion and career structures, and you've got places like is it Huddersfield that has this target I think achieved of having every single teacher, every single lecturer accredited by the HEA. So there are, I mean, you could argue the toss about how important that is and actually whether having an HEA qualification necessarily means you're a good teacher or not, but you know, people are at least looking at this and trying to take it seriously as an issue. which perhaps they weren't 10 years ago, I'm not sure.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, moving on to a research issue from this week's magazine. Lizzie, you went up to Leeds to judge the three-minute thesis competition. Sounds very interesting. Perhaps it won't strain your Glastonbury weary voice too much if you could take us through what happened there. What was it all about? It sounds a bit of a challenge, cramming thesis into, 180 seconds?
Yeah, it's obviously a huge amount of work and very often specific work people are doing within their PhD, and they've got to talk about it in 3 minutes. But it's a great idea. I think it started actually in Australia a couple of years ago in 2008, but it's rocketed there, and now it's growing in popularity. We've had the first UK-wide competition that was organised by Leeds University Union. And I think it's popular because it's a really useful thing. Students want to be able to talk about their research that they're doing, and also it helps build all these skills that we can't stop talking about now. It's not just about doing research. You probably, most of them won't, unfortunately, if they want to, end up being academics. They're going to go out into the wide world, and these are exactly the kind of skills that you're going to need in a huge number of jobs. And also, if you are an academic, increasingly, you know, we're talking about the ref, impact is king, and you have to be able to talk about your work and explain to the public. It's not just your peers that you have to be able to explain it to. So it was really popular. It was very interesting to see actually a great difference, all the different subject matters and different techniques, but it's very simple actually. It's very old school, I would say, what you have to do, because you get one slide, 3 minutes, and there's no music. And they felt the need to specify no rapping, no props.
no rapping rule. Always,
I know,
gets me.
It's terrible.
I think three minutes actually sounds quite generous in this, for the sort of Twitter generation where you used to 140 characters. That'll be next, won't it? Your thesis in 140 characters.
Well, you know what the other thing I thought it was useful for is, because I know quite a few people who have been PhD students in the past, and they're always at parties, people say, oh, what do you do? You say, oh, I'm doing a PhD. Oh, what's that in? And you just go, oh, don't bother. but now maybe they'll, if they give them three minutes, if they're generous, they'll be able to explain.
Yeah, we'll find out who won that on page 11. It's an interesting read. That's given me an idea, John, actually. I might use our Twitter account to ask for a hashtag tweet my thesis, maybe.
Yeah,
I'm going to give that a go. So do check out at Times Higher Ed Twitter feed for that. But from a rather light-hearted competition to something rather different. Jack, your feature this week, part of our Outer Limits series, this is our series that looks at research outside the comfort zone. You were speaking to a lecturer who's been researching the role of dogs in gang culture. I noticed it's illustrated by a particularly graphic photograph this week. What's it about? How did you come across this?
Well, this is a quite an interesting report by an academic called Simon Harding, and he was a man who was involved in community safety work for many years, and he worked for the Home Office, and then he decided to take a PhD, and he was writing his PhD thesis on gang culture, and he saw a particularly gruesome story about a teenager who'd been murdered by a gang who used dogs to basically bring this poor boy down and stab him to death. And so he thought, no, this is something I haven't really seen in my many years working in this field. So I want to sort of find out a bit more. But the feature is really about how he managed to meet these rather shady characters who are hanging out in parks and people you don't really see. And I don't think academia really comes into contact with these people very much. So it was quite an interesting tale of how he managed to get into this subculture, this sort of criminal underworld, where these dogs are sort of traded like commodities and then forced to fight against each other in pretty gruesome ways.
I was quite interested in the, because there's some discussion in the piece about the ethics of studying something like this. And actually, when you read between the lines, he doesn't actually seem to have attended any actual dogfights on the basis that he obviously would potentially be putting himself at risk, but B, they were illegal and he didn't think he should be there. But that struck me as a slightly unusual thing for an academic to say, because you would assume that people studying all sorts of very unethical behaviour, it's not unethical for you as the academic to go there and witness it in first hand. Did he say anything about that, his reasons for not actually going to the fights themselves?
Well, I mean, this guy, he sort of knows his onions. He has dealt with gangs in the past, and he's not averse to meeting with these sort of gang members on the street. So he knows who they are, but he just felt it just wasn't really something he could, a position he could put himself in, because it is a very dangerous world. And if you've seen some of these dogs as he has, he probably knows that it's a very dicey place to put yourself in as an academic. And he felt that through his interviews with the people, he wasn't actually so much interested in the dogs and the spectacle himself. He's more interested in the psychology aspects, of these people and how this, you know, how and why they were getting involved in this culture with pitting dogs against each other. So, I mean, he said he could have gone to one if he so chosen, put his safety in the hands of some rather, as I said, shady people, but he decided not to do that. He felt like he had enough material from speaking to these people. That was the focus of his study.
It's interesting reading. It's fascinating, really. We had a number of these articles now, and we'll have more just to see some of the sort of diverse topics that academics find themselves studying.
Exactly. And the ones we've had before, academics from the UK have gone off to Latin America and investigated mass graves in the country, and we've had one where a scientist went down in some deep cave in Romania. But this shows that actually, you know, there are some rather interesting studies to be done in Britain that we don't know about, and he's gone out and through several years of quite hard work he's managed to produce this study, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Page 42 this week if you want to take a look at that one. We should quickly draw attention to another feature, the cover feature, in fact, in which Danny Dorling, who is Professor of Human Geography at the University of Sheffield, sort of delves into the impact of changing global demographics on the academy. John, I know your leader was sort of inspired by that piece this week. Where did that come from and what's it looking
like? Yeah, I mean, Danny Dorling's a really, really interesting guy. He's sort of a bit of a rising star in sort of public engagement work as well. He was talking at the RSA this week, or next week, sorry, on the same theme, and he's got a new book out called 10 Billion, which refers to the, one of the slight difficulties of publishing. When he wrote the book, all the formal predictions were that the world population would peak at 10 billion at the turn of the next century, and since the book's been published, that prediction's been upgraded to 11 billion, which is probably a bit annoying if you just do 10 billion, but there you go, such is life.
The speedy world of turning a book around.
That's right, yeah, but it's a fascinating piece. We asked Danny to write a piece specifically looking at how changing demographics will influence higher education and the flow of students around the world and how higher education needs to be delivered, whether that's in, you know, physical, residential degree format, or by MOOCs and all these other things we talk about week in, week out. But he's done a really fascinating piece looking at the really interconnected nature of higher education and the world population. And it's much more complex and sort of much more complex cause and effect between the two than you might think. So, for example, if you have more women going further into levels of education, into tertiary education, they tend to have children later in life than they would otherwise have done, perhaps have fewer children, which in turn, of course, has a knock-on effect on population numbers further down the line. And so there's all sorts of very interesting ways that levels of higher education participation affect what happens to demographics further down the line. I mean, there's actually, although we're predicted to peak at 10 or 11 billion...
I think it's just gone up to 12, actually.
That's right, yeah. At the turn of the century, we've actually... that's mainly because people are going to be living longer. Danny Dorling says we've actually passed what he calls peak baby, which is the year that more babies are born than there will be in future, because fertility rates are falling. And again, that's partly because more women are getting further into their education careers. And but he says we haven't yet passed peak graduate, but we will... relatively soon in terms of the total potential number of graduates there are, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we'll start to see student numbers fall off, because again, you could just have people doing degrees later in life as mature students, or more students, you know, greater participation rate of the potential people you have. And the other thing, interesting thing from a UK perspective, is that we are facing for the first time a dip in the number of 18-year-olds coming out of schools and sixth forms right now. So we've, for years, and this has really been the expansion of British higher education has been built on, in recent decades, we've had ever increasing numbers of 18-year-olds coming through the system. And that's not happening anymore. It's starting to dip. And I think that's interesting. Will be an interesting challenge for universities too, that you haven't necessarily got the steady increasing supply coming through. And of course, the government doesn't necessarily have the money that it once did for ever increasing numbers of students subsidised through the student loan system. So that's a big challenge for British universities in the next little period.
And I suppose allied to that, you've got the rise of universities in Europe offering English language courses. I mean, that's where these people in developing countries, that's the language they want to speak. Increasingly, I'm hearing universities in Holland, Germany, France, Italy, all offering many more English language courses. So not only do we have this demographic dip, we've also got more competition for our services.
Yeah, but when you look at where students are going to come from in the future, I mean, there's some great and brilliant graphs in this piece. And you can just look at something like India, graph for India, which has an exploding population, as we know, exploding middle class, a deep affinity for British education, and, you know, numbers of Indian students expecting to be going into tertiary education is increasing right up to 2050 very dramatically. And one of the things that I talk about in the lead of this week is that you've kind of got this strange situation where we have a potentially falling numbers of young British people coming out of schools, ever-increasing numbers of students from places like India looking for a higher education, and then we've got this daft visa policy going on, which is kind of poisoning the well a bit overseas for Britain. So there's loads of interesting trends in this piece, and it's well worth a read just to look at kind of how things connect to each other and how some of the policies we've got in this country at the moment, how crazy they are when you look at where the world's going.
Absolutely, yeah. Page 34 for that. I'm glad you flagged up the graphs, actually. There's loads of data and stats to get your teeth into on that one, so make sure you check it out. We're running out of time now. I did say I'd flag up one quick piece. It's one of mine, actually, about how universities are increasingly marketing to parents in order to recruit students. I thought I'd just ask the people who are here quickly whether they think that's a good thing, and maybe remembering back to when you went to university, whether your parents played a particularly big role in where you decided to go ultimately.
I don't think they did at all, really, no. From what I can remember. I read in your piece that a lot of the time parents are now going along with their kids to open days, but I'd never have had my parents along, I mean.
It's, I think if you're 18, the last thing you want is your mum telling you where to go to university. And actually, I completely side with David Willetts to an extent on this. I know it's his argument that people might take issue with, but as far as the financial commitment's concerned, because people say there's a lot more money involved now, so parents should have a say, well, no one's asking the parents to save up and put the money up front, so I don't see why it shouldn't be the students' decision.
Yeah, well, I can't remember much advice on the university front, but then my parents were very supportive, but not particularly helping me choose a university.
No, I think I'd go along with that as well. Since we got a tweet sent through, several tweets from a lecturer this week that said their child was probably going to go to an Ivy League university in the US rather than stay in the UK, because they'd worked out how much it would cost. They'd worked out how much it would cost to fly the child back twice yearly. They'd sort of weighed that up against increasing fees, looked at her interests and decided which course would be best. And then in the last tweet revealed that this child was 11 years old.
Yeah. So, I was going to object to your use of the word child. They're children, they're students. In this case, actually, was a child.
But have a look at that too. As ever, you can discuss all the issues we've chatted about today on our Facebook page. We're on Google+. We're on Twitter, as we've already mentioned. You'll find us on LinkedIn. We've got a new company page on LinkedIn, in fact, to go along with our groups page. There's the old-fashioned timeshighereducation.co.uk as well, with all the content and places for you to comment, and the even older-fashioned magazine, of course, so please make sure you are getting your Times Higher the way that you want to. But until next week, thanks for joining me, everybody. We'll have another issue review in a week's time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.